Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is a special election edition of Your Call. San Francisco Supervisors Jane Kim and Scott Wiener are in tight race to fill California State Senator Mark Leno's seat, representing San Francisco and San Mateo in the California legislature. Whoever wins in November could hold this important seat in Sacramento for as many as 12 years and represent 1 million people. 2 weeks ago, we were joined by Supervisor Scott Wiener, and today we are joined by Supervisor Jane Kim. In 2010, Jane Kim was elected to the Board of Supervisors representing District 6. It includes the Tenderloin, south of Market, Mission Bay, and Treasure Island. She represents some of the poorest and wealthiest residents in San Francisco. Jane Kim sits on the Land Use Committee, serves as chair of the City and School District Committee, and is a member of the Trans Bay Joint Powers Authority. In 2006, Jane Kim was the top vote getter elected to the Board of Education in San Francisco. She began her public service career as a community organizer at the Chinatown Community Development Center and then as a civil rights attorney at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. Jane Kim has been endorsed by the California Federation of Teachers, the California Nurses Foundation, Emily's List, the Sierra Club, Unite Here Local 2, former San Francisco Supervisor Matt Gonzalez, Senator Cory Booker, and Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders was in town last weekend at a rally for Jane Kim and California Proposition 61. So what questions do you have for Supervisor Jane Kim? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Supervisor Kim joins me in studio. Hi, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So why do you want to become a senator in California? What I think is so fascinating right now about state legislatures is because Republicans have pretty much hijacked everything that happens mm-hmm. in Washington, D.C., what happens in state senates are so, so important. Mm-hmm. And as we saw, Jerry Brown signed more than 800 pieces of legislation mm-hmm. just recently. So why do you want that job?
I think the California State Legislature is one of the most relevant lawmaking bodies in the country. Sacramento passes 2 to 3 times as many bills as Washington, D.C., which is not hard to do anymore. Mm. And I agree with you. State legislatures are increasingly becoming the most important voices for our country, not just in California, but across the state. Most of the issues that we care about, whether it is the environment, prison reform, criminal justice, public education, K-12, public higher education, all of these issues are being fought at the state level today. And even issues like gay marriage were being fought at the state level prior. So I think we're going to increasingly see this continue. And the other reason why it is so important for us to focus on state legislatures is actually that the Republican Party has done this for a very long time. And because Republicans control the majority of the state legislatures and governor seats across the country, they've also been able to control redistricting lines every 10 years, which then also impacts who's able to win Congress. I actually believe that progressive values, democratic values represent the majority of America, that if lines were done correctly, that Democrats would be the majority in Congress and Congress would be able to take on tough issues like in the environment.
Well, speaking of the environment, we just did a show about last night's presidential debate, mm-hmm. and unfortunately, climate change has not come up at all mm-hmm. in these debates. And so I wanted to ask you about this, because California is now in its 6th year of the drought. So many environmentalists say it's just going to get worse. These raging fires in the state are mm-hmm. now the new norm. And James Hansen, former NASA director and well-known climate scientist, said that we're in deep trouble here. He says the Paris Climate Summit is great, but it's not enough. We're not mm-hmm. doing what's needed. Now, California really leads the way, mm-hmm. as you know, and Governor Brown signed a package of climate change legislation recently. The lead around the world is California has become a petri dish for international efforts to slow mm-hmm. global warming. Where do you stand on this issue, and what do you plan to do about this massive issue if you become a senator in California?
The environment is probably one of the most pressing issues of our time, and I'm proud that California has led one of the boldest and strongest standards for reducing carbon emissions in the country. This is work that Congress should be taking up, but cannot. given the Republican chokehold that has happened in the House in Washington, D.C. And so Sacramento, again, has had to make up for where D.C. has fallen behind. And both Governor Brown and the California State Legislature, through AB 32, has made strong environmental protections one of its leading accomplishments, and they renewed that recently. And I do believe that we are leading the way. That being said, even as a leader on environmental issues, California is facing some of the most pressing issues around water, land use. Something that I care deeply about is making sure that we're building affordable housing near places where people work. Something that has made me incredibly sad is that not just in San Francisco, but in cities across the country, that the fastest growing demographic in our nation's homeless count are working families. In New York City and L.A. and San Francisco, I forget if it was the New York Times or the L.A. Times, said that the new face of homelessness are single working mothers with children. And what that means is that people with jobs cannot afford to live in the cities that they work in. And there is something wrong if you're working 40 hours a week, making minimum wage, and you can't find a single apartment to rent with your children. And we have a lot more to do around building more housing and affordable housing in our cities.
Mm. Well, so speaking of that, I mean, you've really worked on affordable housing here in San Francisco. A lot of homeless advocates here say it really needs to come at the federal level with HUD funding.
Absolutely.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But until that can happen, unfortunately, the states and the cities have to take action. And so, again, going to the Senate, you're going to have a much larger microphone.
Yeah.
And so how do you plan to use it? Let's talk first about homeless issues,
mm-hmm.
Because in one of the wealthiest states in the country, we've got, obviously, as you know, a massive, massive homeless crisis.
Slightly over 20% of the nation's homeless count resides in the state of California. And so this is a statewide issue. I don't believe that the city of San Francisco and Los Angeles can solve homelessness on its own. And to go back a little bit to contextualize this issue, yes, it is a federal issue. There was a time in the 60s and 70s that the federal government adequately funded affordable housing. And we actually had more public housing units online than people on the wait list. And if you talk to social workers during that time, they said, you know, if a family or an individual became homeless, we used to rapidly be able to rehouse them. And then starting in the 80s, President Reagan started to slash funding to HUD. And over three presidential administrations, we slashed HUD funding by 50%. And at the same exact time in the 80s, homelessness began to emerge as a national urban phenomenon in cities across the country. So when people say housing is the only solution to homelessness, housing is the only solution to homelessness. Decades later, though, we're dealing with the fact that now we have people aging in place on our streets, people that are getting sicker and growing weaker. And so now homelessness is no longer just an economic and housing issue. It's become a public health issue as well, which is why here at the local level, I fought for and won nurses and health professionals that are finally in our shelter systems, both during the day and the night. And I won $6.6 million from the mayor's office last year, and we're currently building out a 24-hour medical respite shelter in my district in the south of Market that will be staffed by nurses, clinicians, and psychologists. Now, I've also said that Sacramento should declare a statewide emergency on homelessness, that just like the brush fires in the south, or any type of natural disaster where people lose their housing, that we should treat homelessness as a statewide emergency as well, and that we need to infuse additional statewide dollars across the state to build more supportive and affordable housing for people that are homeless. And two, we should have a consistent system of care. We have counties in the state of California that refuse to institute a 365-day shelter system. So where are they going to go? They're going to go to San Francisco and Los Angeles. And I think the state has a lot to do to make services more consistent throughout the state.
Mm. So these programs, and when you talk about wraparound services, mm-hmm. I think that needs a lot more attention, because you can't just put someone in a room.
Mm-hmm.
They need services that
mm-hmm.
cost money.
Yep.
Which we do have in a wealthy state like California.
Mm-hmm.
But when State Senator Mark Leno was on last week, he said, as much as I like and respect Governor Brown, he's very tight with the purse strings.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't like to spend money on these
mm-hmm.
issues. So how are you going to deal with that in Sacramento?
You know, I've thought a lot about what it would mean to be a progressive voice in Sacramento. I know that I will be to the left of many of my colleagues, and I don't want to just go up there and be a symbolic vote on progressive issues. And so I've looked at, well, where can I really make a difference? I think there are a couple of places. One, public education. I used to serve on the school board. I was a youth organizer working with our public school students for many years, and also affordable higher education. And second, actually, is our prison system and sentencing reform, which actually Governor Brown does care very much about. To go hand in hand with these two issues, you know, California state budget has largely remained the same over the last 30 years. 40% goes to K-12 and community college. 30% goes to health and human services. We have one of the highest poverty rates in the country. And the final 30% goes to everything else you can imagine. So close to 50% of our state budget goes to education. Yet I don't think Sacramento spends 50% of its time on K-12 issues. And that is an expertise that I'm excited to bring to Sacramento and to make a centerpiece of my policy work. But I want to go back to the final 30%, which funds everything you can imagine. Highways, parks, you name it, that's in the final 30%. There were two line items that changed significantly over the last 30 years in California. One, most people can guess, prison spending. Mm. It went from 3% to 9% of our state budget. Only one other line item changed as significantly, and that was higher education, funding to Cal State and UCs. It went from 18% of our budget to 12% of our budget, exactly 6 percentage points. So when people talk about the school to prison pipeline, that is very real. Our budget is a document that states our values and our priorities. And California has decided that our prison system is the institution that it is investing in for young Californians to end up in. We built 23 state prisons over the last 30 years and only one UC and three CSUs. We have to significantly change this. And I'm really excited that actually even Republicans are now starting to pay attention to how expensive our prison system has become and how it's actually not making our community safer. And a red state like Nebraska, where the state legislature overturned the death penalty, that's huge. And so as a progressive voice, I'm really hoping that I can make a difference on these two key issues.
You talked about affordable housing, and that's very prominent in your campaign. What we don't often talk about is what the word affordable actually means, because, I mean, you've got people who are making very good salaries in San Francisco who can't afford housing, and then you have people who are sleeping in church pews who get a Social Security check, $1,000 a month, who obviously can't afford housing. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
Affordable, what does that mean? Who's that really for?
So under federal HUD guidelines, if you make under $84,550 a year, you qualify for affordable housing. 60% of San Franciscans qualify for affordable housing under federal HUD guidelines, but it's a huge range from people who make zero income to $84,550 a year. And so one of the hard things about working on affordable housing is that every time you fight for funding or you work with market rate developers so that they can privately contribute more affordable housing, you're excited to win more housing, but you know you're not doing enough at every single level. And you always have to pick, like this time you're like, we're going to get more supportive housing for those that are formerly homeless and have very little income. And then the next deal negotiate, you say, we're going to fight for middle class housing. And you know, I'll give a couple of examples. The first time I was able to win 40% affordable middle-income housing on site was the Giants parking lot, which many people park in. It's going to build close to 1,000 units of housing. And for the first time ever, San Francisco, through my office, won 40% affordable and middle-income housing. To get a sense of the range, 12% were set aside for households of four making $55,000 a year, roughly. So ballpark concessionary workers could afford that. The final 28% were actually set aside for households of four making between $80,000 and $150,000 a year. Nurses, teachers. We worked very closely, actually, with the teachers union to negotiate that deal. And what is really stunning about that is that we are now fighting for housing that the market used to take care of. People that make very good income in San Francisco can't afford to live here in San Francisco anymore. And so when I say I fight for affordable housing, and I'm proud to have won the most affordable middle-income housing of any member of this current board, it is a very broad range of people that we are fighting for. Mm.
And when we talk about all of this new construction in San Francisco and around the Bay Area, what about infrastructure? Because I've never seen things this bad on the roads, on public transportation. Just people are very aggressive on the road. Mm-hmm. People are frustrated. I mean, what's going on behind the scenes? Is this something that supervisors are talking about? Because I don't hear many politicians really talk much about infrastructure and how to deal with all of these people coming to this area.
infrastructure is probably one of the unsexiest things to talk about in public policy world. But of course, it's so important, as you just mentioned. Infrastructures include parks and open space so that we can create healthy and activated neighborhoods. Infrastructure includes public transportation, roads, bike lanes, pedestrian safety. All of these things are incredibly important. We do talk a lot about how we can reduce the number of cars on a road, because as we continue to grow in residents and workers, it's just not simply realistic that everyone's going to be able to drive. So how do we incentivize different types of behavior? One thing that I have really pushed for, at least within San Francisco, is Vision Zero. We want to make sure that our residents feel safe biking and walking on our streets. And in fact, we've seen surveys that have said that residents are more likely to get out of their cars and into bikes than out of their cars and onto Muni. And maybe there's a sense of independence when you're on your bike. So let's make it safer to bike in San Francisco. Let's reduce the number of cars, at least within the city, that way. And, you know, 2 years ago, last year, I got to visit Copenhagen, where 60% of Copenhagen and the entire region bikes every single day to work and school. When you just count within Copenhagen, the percentage is much, much higher. And they are able to dramatically reduce the number of cars on their roads. And it wasn't always that way. Copenhagen used to be clogged by cars as well. Of course, we have to really invest in public transit so that they're affordable, but also convenient ways for people to get around, not in their cars as well. So there's a lot of work to do here. Mm.
Today, we're speaking with San Francisco Supervisor Jane Kim. She and Scott Weiner are in a tight race to fill California State Senator Mark Leno's seat representing San Francisco and San Mateo County. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We've got full line Supervisor Kim. One question from a listener: would you please talk more about tackling climate change? You talked about it being an important challenge, but what are you going to do? What kind of legislation or public policies will you fight for? This is such an important issue.
Well, first of all, I'm really proud to have gotten the endorsement of our Sierra Club here nationally and also in the state of California, and for their faith and belief in my leadership on environmental issues. I do think one of the most important things that we can do for the environment is reduce our carbon emissions. In fact, it is the largest contributor here in the state of California. And one of the ways to do that is to build more housing where people work. That is simply one of the most important solutions to reducing our carbon footprint, is to do transit-oriented urban, dense housing development near places of employment. And the more that we can get people out of their cars and to reduce our reliance on gas-fueled automobiles, the better off we are going to be as a state. Second, I think there's a lot that we can do around reducing our water consumption. And San Francisco has been leading. We, on average, use under, I believe, 100 gallons of water per individual. We have, counties and cities in Southern California that are using 3 to 4 times as much water as we do per capita. And we need to be able to spread this practice throughout the state and ensure that we are reducing, that we're reusing, that we're looking at gray water infrastructure in our building construction, and that we're also looking at reducing our reliance on certain types of energy pollutants and looking more to wind and solar.
All right. Well, thank you for that question. Let's go to Sally Ann in Soma. Hi, Sally Ann. Welcome to the show. Hi, Sally Ann. Go ahead.
My name is Sonia. I have a question. This was a good talk about encouraging transit-oriented development, but there are the AHBP was a real upzoning, which would have encouraged that kind of development, or the governor's Buy Right program that would have encouraged transit-oriented development. And right now, Jane Kim has a ballot proposition, Prop X, which could kill up to 1,000 units of housing in the Mission and Soma, both, transit-oriented development. So I guess my question is, what gives? It's easy to come on the radio and talk about transit-oriented development, but when you've been in office, you haven't voted to make it happen.
All right. Thanks, Sonia.
Hi, Sonia Trauss. Nice to hear your voice. Sonia, a couple of things that I'll say. My measure, Proposition X, is about ensuring that we're protecting production, distribution, repair, and arts within the South of Market and the Mission.
And just to let people know, so, and I'm getting this from San Francisco Public Press, X would require that developers and part of the Mission and SOMA build replacement space if their projects displace arts activities, certain light industrial and craft business or community-related mm-hmm. facilities.
And the reason why this came about is that I was doing a lot of work around affordable housing and making sure that we were protecting our tenants, our renters, homeowners, so they can continue to afford to live here. But then what we were finding was that we were losing their jobs. We were losing our arts organizations, our artists. We were losing auto repair shops. We were losing elevators, shipping. All of these are actually, they can be high-paying jobs, you know, 20-something, 30-something dollars an hour, but they don't require a college degree. So just as important as it is to build housing, it is also just as important for us to protect the jobs that allow people to thrive here in San Francisco. And frankly, San Francisco has always been a city about diversity. We're not just losing our tenants. We're losing our arts organizations. We're losing our nonprofits. We're losing, again, our auto repair shops. That, you know, provide services throughout the neighborhood. So land use is about a balance. Not everything can be market rate housing and office. We need to make sure that, of course, we're building market rate housing and more office, but we also have to make sure that we're building production, distribution, repair spaces, spaces for the arts, and that we're also building a lot of affordable housing. I'm really proud of the fact that I represent a district that is currently absorbing 80% of all of San Francisco's commercial and residential development. I support growth. I just believe that this growth has to be balanced. That is, we build more market rate housing, that we're also working and negotiating hard with our developers to say, we also want you to build more low-income and middle-class housing along with your market rate housing. And I have been a hard negotiator on behalf of our city, but I have ultimately been able to support a lot of development because our developers work with our office. And I've said this before, and I'll say this again. I want developers to run their businesses in San Francisco, but I don't want developers running San Francisco.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Sonia. Let's go next to Christine in San Francisco. Hi, Christine.
My question is about Proposition O in San Francisco. And all of the literature I've gotten in the mail is basically supporting Proposition O. When I feel like instead of building more office space, we should really be building more housing.
So Proposition O would amend the planning code to exempt a mixed-use redevelopment megaproject in the Bayview Hunters Point neighborhood from previous voter-approved citywide limits on office space and allow construction to be expedited there.
Mm-hmm. So the vast majority of the shipyard project, although this was before my time on the Board of Supervisors when it was approved, is housing. And the shipyards has also committed high levels of affordable housing as well on site as a former redevelopment area plan. It is a mixed-use site, so a mixed-use plan, and it does include housing. And because of the commitments that the developer has made on the site, they want to move forward with a ballot measure that would exempt them from Proposition M, which was passed in the 1980s here in San Francisco, that limits the number amount of office space we can build on any given year here in San Francisco. It's overall a good ordinance because the listener pointed out, we want to make sure that we're building a good balance, a ratio between office and housing. But I believe the shipyard project is doing a good balance of building housing, which is the primary element of this plan, and building some office as well, which is why I'm supporting Proposition O.
All right. Thank you for that call. Let's go next to Jack in San Francisco. Hi, Jack. Welcome to the show. Go ahead, Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm calling because I wanted to know why the supervisor supported the Twitter tax break, even though she says she's for companies giving their fair share.
Hi, Jack. So the mid-market tax exclusion was one of my first legislation that I authored. I wasn't actually just a co-sponsor, as my opponent said a couple weeks ago. I was actually the primary author of that legislation. And when it came to my desk, my first week in office, it already had 6 votes. And I generally do not believe in tax breaks for companies. I think that everyone should want to pay their taxes because it's their investment in our roads, our schools, et cetera. That being said, when I ran in 2010, I did run on a platform of prioritizing the production of affordable housing. But what I heard over and over again we were in the depth of the recession then, from voters was, please protect jobs. Please bring more jobs into San Francisco. And at the time, we were hitting a low in our general fund budget because of decreases in tax revenue. And we had a major company saying that they were going to leave San Francisco. And there are a couple of things that brought me over into supporting this tax exclusion. One, Twitter wanted to move into a building that had been vacant for 50-plus years. And it required immense tenant improvements to work into that site. Mid-market had the highest commercial vacancy rate of any commercial corridor in San Francisco, 30%. And so we examined tax exclusions across the state of California to see, well, do they really work? Do they actually really revitalize neighborhoods or not? And we found actually that they generally don't. But there were some exceptions to the rule, and one of them was this. If you're able to attract an anchor tenant, which then attracts other tenants into an area, it can revitalize a neighborhood. And we knew that Twitter was one of those anchor tenants. And so what I did is I worked carefully with the controller to say, all right, let's really tailor this tax exclusion to address the very issue we're talking about, which is commercial vacancy. So if you look at the mid-market tax boundaries now, it's actually different from how it was originally proposed. Originally, it was the entire mid-market corridor. We actually carved out any buildings that didn't have historical rates of commercial vacancy. So, for example, Square and Uber moved in right next door to Twitter, but because that building didn't have historical rates of commercial vacancy, they're paying all their taxes. So if you move into a building, though, that had been historically vacant, yes, you get a tax exclusion for 6 years on any net new jobs you create in that corridor. Now, originally, Twitter wanted a total tax break. They didn't want to pay any taxes. I pushed back up against them and said, you're going to have to continue paying the taxes you pay now, but on any net new jobs you create in mid-market, yes, we'll give you an exclusion for 6 years. And actually, they wanted much more than that. It was a very lengthy negotiation. Ultimately, I am proud of the work that we were able to do. Would I pass that legislation today? No, but in 2011, when we're at the depth of our recession, when the number one issue I heard from voters was jobs, 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 I do think it was the right choice, and we narrowly tailored it to address specifically the issue we're trying to address, which was the highest commercial vacancy in any corridor in San Francisco.
Do you think that attracting those companies has led to the affordable housing crisis in San Francisco?
The economy was swinging back into San Francisco, and I would love to say that the mid-market tax exclusion is the reason for all the success that San Francisco has had. But just as I can't say that, I can't say that is also the cause of all of its woes either. Yes, having a growth of high-wage jobs in San Francisco has pushed up the cost of housing and rent here in San Francisco. And that is a tremendously challenging issue. But I really believe that we just need to build more affordable middle-income housing and that we as a city should be able to absorb the growth that we're seeing in our city, but we need to do it equitably. And that's been the biggest problem, is that the growth is not happening equitably. And unfortunately, the city and county of San Francisco has a wealth gap comparable to countries like Rwanda. This is according to our own Human Services Agency data. And so we have a lot of work to do around the wealth gap here in San Francisco.
Today, we are joined by San Francisco Supervisor Jane Kim. She and Scott Wiener are in a tight race to fill California State Senator Mark Leno's seat. He's being termed out, representing San Francisco and San Mateo County. 2 weeks ago, Scott Wiener joined us, and today we're joined by Jane Kim. If you have a question for Jane Kim, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And again, if you haven't registered yet, you have until Monday. Let's go next to DYA in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's Dayamudra. Supervisor Kim, I'm really appreciating all the attention you're bringing to housing. I'm a teacher, and 8 years ago I was able to buy a condo at below market rate thanks to a special program that the city offered to keep teachers and cops and firefighters in the city. And it was really hard to get a mortgage. There was a special division of Wells Fargo, and they've since closed. So actually refinancing, it's almost impossible to get any help on that. And I haven't heard the BMR units be part of the discussion. It seems like such an important and easy solution. So I'm wondering if you have any ideas about offering more BMR units to working people to keep us in the city.
Yeah, so I have been the biggest fighter of below market rate units. That's when we talk about affordable housing provided by market rate developers and deals that I've negotiated. These are all below market rate units, 100% subsidized and paid for by our market rate developers. So when I talked about our giant steal, when we for the very first time achieved 40% affordable middle income housing on any site in our city, that was a deal that we made with a market rate developer. And 40% of the units on site will be set aside for those that make anywhere between $55,000 and $150,000 a year. We then signed two other deals where we hit 40%. And by the way, we're the only city in the country that's been able to achieve 40% on site. We have 180 Folsom, which 40% of those home ownership units are going to be set aside for households of four that make between $80,000 and $120,000 a year, and I'm very proud of that deal as well. And then recently with the 5M deal, we've also achieved 40% affordable housing, and this is going to be a much broader range, including offsite housing for families and individuals that are formerly homeless, seniors on fixed income, and again, households of four that make between $80,000 and $150,000 a year. The issue, though, is we're, of course, not building enough of these. I'm proud of every unit I've fought for and won, but we have a lot more work to do. And I've been working very closely with the teachers union. I brought them into the negotiating table with our market rate developers, and some of our developers are going to actually do some teacher preference in their developments because they are providing those units and aren't using any public dollars. And I'm really proud of the fact that I had the support of the California Teachers Association, AFT 2121, California Federation of Teachers, and of course our local United Educators of San Francisco Teachers Union.
Thank you, Dayamudra. Let's go next to Joanna. Hi, Joanna. Welcome to the show.
Hello?
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. So, Jean, traditionally, I know that you're one of the more progressive voices of San Francisco. But I also noticed one of your major backers is the American Beverage Association, which I know is a very rich industry and has been known to stop several health initiatives all over the state and country. So I just want to know that if elected to the Senate, are you going to be someone that will fight for the health of our community, and how you plan on doing so with the American Beverage Association on your side?
Thank you for that question. I don't have a single dollar that has come into my campaign from Big Soda, and you can look this up. It's all public records. Big Soda has, however, paid a lot of money to Slate cards that have gone no on the soda tax. And these are Slate cards that include both myself and my opponent, Scott Wiener. So we are both beneficiaries of Big Soda money coming in. If the Slate went no on V.
Can I just ask you about this? Because this is getting some attention. San Francisco Examiner columnist Joe Fitz reported that a sea of soda money is backing Jane Kim as more than $180,000 in spending by the American Beverage Association has boosted her campaign.
So what he is referring to is that if clubs endorse me and they went no on V, then Big Soda gives those Slate cards additional money to send out their mailers. So none of that money has directly come to my campaign. But there are also Slate cards that went yes on Scott and also went no on V. And Big Soda also gave a lot of money to those Slate cards as well. Big Soda doesn't care about the state Senate race. They just care about Slate cards that have no on the soda tax on it. Now, I have also gone no on the soda tax, and that is because, in general, I don't support regressive and flat taxes. But that's not because I support Big Soda. I just don't believe in taxing poor people to change their behavior. Regressive flat taxes impact low-income households 8 times more than their wealthy counterparts. And flat regressive taxes also negatively impact middle-class households 5 times more than their wealthy counterparts. If we're going to look at taxation, we should look at progressive taxation. And that's why I introduced Proposition W, which is an ultra-luxury housing and building tax on sales of buildings and home $5 million and above. And we're saying, you know, we can't stop the luxury housing market, but we can certainly ask you to contribute just a little bit more to make San Francisco more equitable. And we are, I've introduced an ordinance setting aside half of these dollars to making City College free again for all San Francisco residents. And when Proposition W passes, and it's polling way better than me, so I know I'm going to have one victory on November 8th, we will be the first city in the country to make community college free again for all of our residents, regardless of age, income, or any type of GPA prerequisite. But in answer to your question about what am I doing about healthy choices, I don't believe in taxing people, especially poor people, for drinking soda to change their behavior. What I do believe in is subsidizing health and healthy and fresh food in low-income neighborhoods. When I ran for office in 2010 in the Tenderloin, the biggest ask I got over and over again was, please bring a full-service grocery store to the Tenderloin. Tenderloin is a food desert, meaning that there is no full-service grocery store in that neighborhood. Yet when I started office, we had 72 liquor stores. So my first years in office, I spent a lot of time pleading with every single grocery retailer I knew, asking them to come to the Tenderloin, and everyone turned me down. And during that time, we successfully worked with the city attorney's office, with SFPD, and we actually closed down about five of our most problematic liquor stores, one of which turned into 826 Valencia, Dave Egger's amazing reading and writing program. It's a beautiful transformation in the neighborhood. But then our residents came up with an idea. They said, you know what? We have all these small business owners that are willing to be in our neighborhood. So why don't we ask them to become a healthy corner store? So our residents, my office, worked with Department of Public Health, and we came up with these public grants. We've now given them out to five liquor stores, and they have now converted to become healthy corner stores, meaning they got subsidies to change, take down their Marlboro and Budweiser ads, and instead put up healthy dieting ads. And then we also worked with them to change their product percentages from tobacco and liquor to fresh and healthy food and produce. And the most amazing part of this transformation is not only are our residents in the Tenderloin now able to access fresh and healthy food at affordable prices, our small business owners are saying, you know, not only did I not realize that I could make money off of food versus tobacco and liquor, my mental health has improved because my clientele has changed. I now have seniors and families that come into my store. Finally, the last effort I've made, we have Heart of the Farmers Market in the Civic Center area that caters to our Tenderloin residents. It is one of the few farmer markets in the country that takes EBT. We worked with the farmers market and applied for a federal grant, and we won this federal grant. And what it does is that it matches your EBT dollar one for one when you buy vegetables, fruit, produce at the farmers market. So we are doubling your purchasing power in order to increase your consumption of fresh and healthy food. And so that has really been my position around this issue, and it's something that I have worked tirelessly on and that I care very deeply about.
We have a couple other questions about money, and unfortunately there's so much money exchanging hands in these elections. The race for Mark Leno's seat is probably going to be the most expensive in history. When Scott Wiener was on, I asked him about the press release that you put out, Follow the Money, behind corporate candidate Scott Wiener, specifically about Chevron making a major contribution mm-hmm. to the group Californians for Jobs and a Strong Economy. And I just want to play his mm-hmm. response.
That you brought that up, because
I'm getting a lot of emails about it.
Yeah, there's actually no factual basis to that whatsoever. I am the only candidate in this race with an environmental record. I'm the only candidate in this race with a record on clean energy. I'm endorsed by the California League of Conservation Voters. Chevron is not supporting me. I have never taken a penny of oil money. That is on my list, along with tobacco and a few others, that of a no-fly zone, where I do not take oil or any fossil fuel money. And there was no Chevron money in the outside expenditure that was done on my behalf in the primary. That was done, by the way, what you didn't mention, what Jane Kim doesn't mention, that expenditure was by Equality California, the largest LGBT civil rights organization in California with a long track record of supporting the LGBT community. And they're going to the mat for me and my campaign because they don't want to have zero LGBT representation out of Sacramento. Mm-hmm.
So Scott Wiener says that this is a lie, that he's not getting money from Chevron. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's in the public records. Chevron gave $300,000 to Equality California, and Equality California then launched negative attack ads against me in the primary. So I understand what Scott's saying. Yes, Chevron didn't directly contribute to his campaign, but they did give to an independent expenditure group, Equality California in this case, that then ran ads on his behalf and against me. And not only Chevron, but the speculators and landlords in Sacramento that fought Ellis Act reform in Sacramento, and also funded attacks on the 2002 and 2006 affordable housing bond has contributed close to $800,000 to Equality California to launch attack ads against me, $250,000 from the Charter School Association. And then Ron Conway has started his own fund of $200,000 to attack me as well. I have been stunned by the close to $1 million of negative IE that has come out against me and on my opponent's behalf. And yes, that money doesn't go directly to my opponent.
Because
we call it dark money.
He says the same thing about you taking money from the Beverage Association. He also
PG&E. But here, I'm gonna make one distinction. Big Soda has not started an IE for me. There's no committee for Jane Kim or against Scott Wiener that Big Soda has given money to. That is a very distinct difference. The realtors, the speculators, Chevron, Fox News, Airbnb, Ron Conway have all given to an IE specifically to oppose my candidacy and to promote my opponent. So that is a big distinction. Big Soda, yes, has given to mailers of slate cards that have endorsed me and gone no envy, just as they have for my opponent, Scott. Now, the PG&E money, yes. In the primary, the California School Employees Association and California Faculty Association, two of my biggest supporters, ran an IE on my behalf, and they got $40,000 from PG&E for that IE. Nothing close to the $1 million that my opponent has seen. But, you know, that being said, I was disappointed to see that money in the race. I don't want to see PG&E money come in on my behalf either. So in July, I submitted a pledge to Scott, and I said, you know what? I don't want PG&E money. You don't want Chevron money. So let's take the Elizabeth Warren pledge. Let's say if any IE comes on our behalf, if Chevron throws $100,000 to you, PG&E throws $100,000 to me, we have to give $100,000 to a charity of your choice. And what that does, if we do it publicly, is that it discourages people from contributing to an IE on our behalf because they know that it's going to come out of our campaign funds ultimately in the end. And I really respect Elizabeth Warren for coming up with this pledge because we can't overturn Citizens United. In fact, my opponent has said that he despises Citizens United. So let's take that money out of our race. He turned down that pledge. I was disappointed. But, you know, now we just have to keep going.
San Francisco Supervisor Jane Kim is vying for Senator Mark Leno's seat in California, representing San Francisco and San Mateo County. And again, you have until Monday to register to vote. Thank you for your emails and phone calls. And Supervisor Jane Kim, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me, Rose. And thank you so much for doing the Elections Edition. There's a lot on the ballot. And regardless of what you decide to do in my state Senate race, I do encourage everyone to come out and vote.
Well, thank you. And coming up after the break, we'll be joined by Kim Alexander with the California Voter Foundation. You have probably received your ballots if you're voting early. And so if you have any questions about ballots and polling places, we will take those after the break.
Listening to a special election edition of Your Call here on 91.7 KLW. Made possible by listener support, Heather Wilson of Alameda, Maria Raven and Andrew Dreskin of Berkeley help keep the local and the public in local public radio. Coming up at noon, it's Bina, followed at 1 by Open Air, our weekly magazine of the performing arts here in the Bay Area, hosted by me, David Latulip. Stay with us.
Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is a special election edition of Your Call. We've got just under 3 weeks until Election Day, and the last day to register to vote is on Monday. And now I would like to welcome Kim Alexander to the show. Kim is founder and president of the California Voter Foundation, a nonprofit group working to improve the election process so it better serves the needs and interests of voters. Hi, Kim. Welcome to the show. Oh, do we not have Kim? All right. I think we just lost Kim Alexander. Is Kim Alexander going to join us? All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. All right, sorry about that. Sometimes technology gets in the way, and it's a live show. But now we are joined by Kim Alexander. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Rose.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So we've got just under 3 weeks until Election Day. Early registration has already started. What are you concerned about this time around? Anything stand out for you?
I want people to vote and vote with confidence. So I'm always worried for the voters. You know, we have a very long ballot, particularly in the Bay Area, and I know that there's a lot of homework for people to do, and we're getting a lot of questions from voters, things like, do I have to vote on everything on the ballot? And the answer is no, you don't. Even, you know, questions like a lot of people are asking, do I have to be registered with the candidate of the party for president that I want to vote for? And the answer is no. That's only something that applies in the primary. But there are a lot of basic questions about the process that voters have. And, you know, that's because we have a lot of first-time voters and a lot of people who are going to vote in this election that haven't voted in a while, so they may be out of practice. And so we're trying to help as many as we can.
And if you have any questions at all about the process, about your voter guide, about your polling place, we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. I hope people vote. There's so many important things on the ballot this time around. And again, the last day to register to vote is on Monday. If you have any questions about the process, 866-798-8255, or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Now, Kim, some friends have received their early ballot and some have not.
Yeah.
How can you figure out if it's coming?
Yeah, a lot of voters are really stressed out about that, and I totally understand. There are reasons why it may be taking longer than usual for your election materials to arrive. But if you're a registered voter at your current address, which, you know, you have to re-register every time you move, so that registration deadline for Monday is not just for people who are registering for the first time, but if you need to update your registration because you moved or you changed your name, you need to fill out a new application, which you can do online at registertovote.ca.gov. But there are a lot of just sort of basic questions that people are dealing with, and we're hoping that people will come on our website at calvoter.org and we'll help people get access to the information that they need. Now, one of the things that's changed is we have fewer post offices operating these days, fewer central offices available for processing mail, so mail takes longer than it used to, and even though last Monday was the official start date of the vote-by-mail period, it was also Columbus Day, so it was a postal holiday. So counties just started sending out their ballots last week, most of them on Tuesday, and they go out in waves. They don't all go at once, and so, you know, you're someone else in your family maybe got their ballot and you didn't get yours. Almost every county has an online lookup tool. You can go online and check the status of your ballot and see if it was issued. You can go online and check if you're registered at your current address. And now is the time to do that while we are in this 3 weeks out period and there's time to get your information updated.
And what is the date? When do people have to mail in their ballots by, people who are voting early? What would you suggest?
You know, the important thing to remember is that even though we call them vote-by-mail ballots, you don't have to return them by mail. You can return them in person, and a growing number of voters choose that option. They return their vote-by-mail ballot to their polling place on Election Day. You can drop it at any polling place within your county on Election Day. If you live in one county and work in another county, you cannot return it to that county, you know, your workplace county's polling place. They won't count it. So you can return it in person. You can take it to your county election office anytime between now and the close of polls on Election Day and return it there. And many counties have drop-off locations at cities that you can take it to and return it there. There is a new grace period. So now under the current law, if your ballot is postmarked by Election Day and received within 3 days of the election, your ballot will be counted in my own county in Sacramento in June during the primary, I personally saw 8,000 ballots that were rescued and allowed to be counted because of this new grace period. So, but it has to be postmarked by that day, and even if it is postmarked by that day, it's no guarantee it will actually arrive within 3 days, because mail can take as long as a week now to get delivered. In some places, your mail goes out of state and then comes back into state before it's delivered, so it can be kind of roundabout. And so if you are going to mail it, you should really put it in the mail a full week before the election. You know, don't wait till the last minute.
Mail goes out of state?
Yeah, in some of the northern counties, it goes over to Nevada before it comes back in. Santa Cruz County, their mail goes gets processed in San Jose, which is in Santa Clara County, before getting delivered in Santa Cruz. So, yeah, it takes a longer journey now because these processing centers have been reduced by the U.S. Post Office.
And wow.
So, yeah, it is taking longer.
I've never heard of this.
Huh. Welcome to my world, Rose.
Jeez. Well, so, all right, how about this? Fill out your ballot as soon as you can and send it in. And we've done a lot of shows about the propositions and the measures. It's completely overwhelming because we've got, well, 17 at the state level and 25 in San Francisco.
No.
And two of my favorite guides, and then you can share yours, Kim, for state propositions, calmatters.org has done an amazing job of just giving you an overview, who's for it, who's against it, who's funding it, and who's funding the opposition. So the calmatters.org, and then the other one is SF Public Press for the 25 measures here in California. Kim, what are some of your favorite guides?
I'm so glad you asked. We have our California Online Voter Guide on our site, and we've been producing this since 1994, so it's the 26th edition of our nonpartisan online voter guide, and it provides quick links to all the key information you need to learn about the propositions, follow the money, find out who endorsed the measures. We also have our proposition song on playing on YouTube now and getting lots of hits, and appreciate people getting the word out about that. It's a really fun 5-minute long sing-along song about the 17 statewide propositions. I realize San Francisco probably could use a song for their measures too, so maybe next time. But really, my favorite site, and also the Secretary of State created this new quick guide to props page that's a great jump page on their site. But I love Voters Edge from the League of Women Voters and MapLight. It's really the pinnacle of online voter education. It's so simple. You type in your address and your zip code. They're not going to retain your data or use it for any commercial purposes. They'll display your full ballot, everything on your ballot. You can drill down and get as much or as little information you need about the candidates and measures. You can follow the money. You can build your own ballot decisions and save those and email those to you. It's also available in Spanish, and it's very nicely designed. It works very easily, and there's no advertising, nothing annoying, no pop-up things that are going to distract you. So VotersEdge.org is a great place for voters to go. We also saw recently the release of California Choices, which is CaliforniaChoices.org from Next10 and IGES, Institute for Governmental Studies at UC Berkeley. And this is a great site that shows you a whole range of organizations, nonprofit groups, unions, other institutions, and what positions they've taken on the various propositions on the ballot. So it's a great shortcut.
Well, thank you for that. And I'm sorry, Kim, we're almost out of time. We're going to have you back. But if anyone has questions about ballots, polling places, if there's confusion, what's the easiest way to deal with these problems?
Call your county registrar of voters. That is the first line of response. And we have a roster on our website that will get you to your county, their phone number, all their online lookup tools that you can use to verify your status.
All right, great. And I'd say the earlier the better. Kim Alexander is president of the California Voter Foundation. Kim, thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you back.
Thanks, Rose. Anytime.
Thank you. And thank you for joining this election, a special edition of Your Call.